class. It's good to see you here. I don't appear to have the microphone on. Can you hear me now more easily? I am having difficulty hearing the instructor. One person is having difficulty hearing the instructor. I suggest you move forward. The rest of you can all stay put. All right, so today, welcome back. Glad to see you all. If you are on the wait list, you should have received email about what to do about that yesterday. It had linked to a Google form that you can only use if you log in with your UVA Gmail account. So if you didn't do that and tried to make me share it with some Gmail account other than that, try again, but from UVA. There's lab tomorrow. Lab tomorrow is optional. We mentioned this earlier, but lab tomorrow will be installing the tools that we will use for most of the semester, so Java and Eclipse. If you already have them installed, or you think you can do it on your own, or you otherwise just hate tomorrow, if you don't show up, that's fine. We're not taking attendance tomorrow in lab. But if you don't have them installed and working, I'd suggest you show up so that we can get that fixed. Yes?
Is the software free available?
Yes, the software is free, available online, open source, anybody can change it, etc. So if you search for Eclipse, it's probably, at one point it was the first hit, it might be the second since that book became popular. But it's pretty high up there, and it will explain how to do everything else. Or you can just come to lab and we'll walk you through it. So that's happening. If you go on Colab, you will see there is a quiz live, the ethics quiz. Most quizzes will be you get to take them once, close book, close notes, everything. This one, we want you to all get 100. Because we want you to get all get 100, you keep taking it until you get 100. Because we want you to get 100. But do take it. It will close on Saturday. And so take it before that. If you're not currently enrolled in the course, but are on wait list and hope to get in soon, don't worry too much about it. We understand how this works. We will not penalize you for not having been enrolled the first week of class. Questions, comments, concerns, other things for me? Okay, so today's lecture. What is computer science and why should you care? So that I don't repeat stuff you've already read, no, I read chapter one of the textbook. I read at least a page of chapter one of the textbook. Okay, as I predicted, I tell you two, we'll make your life easier and you don't. So, we'll move forward thusly. So to define computer science, we first have to define a computer, which is surprisingly awkward to do. The Oxford English Dictionary, my second favorite dictionary, but the one I happen to have on hand, had these three definitions for computer once you chop out most of the words. It's a person who makes calculations, or a device for facilitating calculations. So any math major, or any slide rule or calculator, so on, count those first two. But the one we usually use is a device used to, and then they had this gigantic long list of things that you can do with information according to variable instructions. So we're going to be able dealing with information and variable instructions, and these are two essential ideas in computing. We won't talk a lot about information today. Hopefully you have some sort of informal, ambiguous idea of what we mean by information, and we'll let it go at that for a while. But we will talk about this variable instruction. One of the features of computers is that I can give the computer instructions that change how it behaves in the future. So this is to some degree true of most devices, but it's particularly true of computers. Some of the instructions for a computer change what the computer does, creates programs and so on, things that we're interested in. And most computers that are commonly used are approximately universal. There's a theorem called the Church-Turing thesis which talks about what this means. But universal means if you can do it, you can do it with a computer. Or I should say, if you can do it with information, then you can make a computer do it with information. This is not proven, but it's pretty much accepted as gospel truth by every mathematician and computer scientist I know. They are universal. Anything that can be done, they can do. Almost. And almost because most computers have a limited amount of memory. They can't remember everything. They can remember some stuff. Okay? So within reason, within small enough problems, we can make it do any small enough problem. And if it's too big for that small enough problem, we just put in more memory and then it can do more. Most computers that exist fit in this category, and usually when we say computer, this is what we will mean. I see many of you writing down. That's fine if you like writing. I will comment again. These slides are already on the website. And after we're finished, the audio recording and everything, nothing I say is being lost if you don't write it down. But if you like writing, by all means, write. So, how many computers have you used in the past 2 weeks? That definition we just had. There's some instructions that change how it works. It's pretty much universal. Anything that can be done, they can do. Figure out the number, count them up, talk to your neighbors, see if you're higher or lower, then we'll take some information. So, try to get the best number you can. What do you think? Any computers? I have used somewhere between 1 and 4. I have used somewhere between 4, 5, and 10. Okay, I have used somewhere between 10 and 20. Only a handful of hands. I have used more than 30. I have used more than 50. Okay, I think we're down to just the TAs. All right, so let's talk about this. You've probably all used more than 50. Okay? Let's start talking about where there are computers. The average car that's been produced in the past 5 years has lots of computers, upwards of 20 in it and by itself. For example, in 2009, I think, 2010, there was a law passed which says, in effect, every new car manufactured must have 8 computers devoted to the tires. One inside each tire and one inside each wheel well. Full programmable computers, and there's rules about how they have to be programmable. There's computers associated with your fuel injection, probably both in your gas tank and when it actually gets to the car. Maybe one for every piston if you've got a really fancy car. There's computers associated with your cruise control and your automatic shifting. Lots of computers just in your car. Most microwave ovens these days have buttons. That uses at least one computer, and possibly two. They may have a second one to figure out where they should shine the microwaves harder. The average laptop computer has between 3 and 5 computers inside it. 3 to 5 separate devices that can be programmed in different ways that operate more or less independently. And so on. We can go down the list. Even old flip phones like I have still have at least 3 computers and probably 5 or 6 inside of them. And every single one of these, there's some kind of instruction we can give it that will change what it does. But the reason I know you've all used at least 50 is because the number of computers involved in just a single web access is at least, at minimum, 8 or 9. And almost every time, it's over 30 or 40, just for one web page. Because your computer talks to another computer, which talks to another computer, which finally gets to the internet service provider, that then talks to 5 or 6 computers along the way to figure out where it's going. It makes a dead end, it backs up, it tries again. This other route's not much better, it backs up, it tries again. It finally gets to where it's going, and then there's another stack of 6 or 7 computers that it talks through on the way down to find out what the web page is. And it does all of that going back again, and it doesn't save the old route. So usually 20 to 30 computers are involved in every single web load you do. Okay? When you do something like Google, on Google's side, they then send your query out to 5 or 6 computers at once on top of that. And there's tons of computers in our life. It's hard to find places that don't have computers. Why? Why are there so many computers in the world? Thoughts? I know why there are computers. Anyone? Yes? They make things easier. Absolutely. Hey, could we drive cars before automatic transmission? Yes, I did it, I know. But it's easier with automatic transmission, which is at least 2 computers. Other reasons. Yeah.
A demand for information.
A demand for information. Yeah. So when I first started school, way back in the dark ages, almost 20 years ago, when you wanted to learn something, you went to the physical library and you looked up in the card catalog where the book was, and you went out to the shelves, and everything was paper all the way down. And most of the time what you were looking for wasn't in the book, and it took 20 minutes flipping through the book. And now what I do is I go to my favorite search engine and I type whatever I want, and if it isn't quite right after 5 or 6 viewings, I give up and try something else. Right? What used to take a trip to a library and then several hours of research, I now do in 5 minutes. Because information is so much easier to give with computers than it is with paper. Unbelievably easier. And it's changed how we do most things. Other reasons we would have so many computers. Yeah? Many of them have one specific function. Absolutely. Why do I have a computer in my microwave? So as a brief reminder, what's a microwave? It's basically a weird light bulb in a metal box. Okay? You put power in the light bulb, it shines microwave radiation, water absorbs it, things get hot. There is no need for a computer in any part of this. We don't even need a computer for the safety catch to make it turn off when you open the door. So why do almost all microwaves that are sold have computers? Yeah. For the timer? We can do timers though with tick, 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 right? So, but that's where we can make timers with them. Yeah. Okay, we have buttons. But what do the buttons do?
Popcorn.
They say popcorn. And what does popcorn mean? Right? It means to set the timer to 3 minutes and set the power at this level, right? So it saves us some memory. But the real reason is, suppose you're in a store and you see two microwaves, and one of them has two little knobs that you have to turn, and one of them has a bunch of buttons. Which one are you going to think is a better microwave? The buttons. Is it any better? Probably not. But we have learned that computers are new and cool, and so they sell. So we add computers to things that have no need of computers. There's some reason we put the computer there the first time, right? The timers are more accurate, and we can program in things like popcorn. There's benefits. But a lot of it is people at large like them without really knowing why. So, we've got all these computers. Lots of reasons we have them. Another reason is they're really cheap, right? Instead of paying somebody $10 to $20 an hour, I pay my computer a few watts. And it's really cheap, like fractions of a cent. There's lots of reasons we have computers. But what's the problem? Are there any risks to having all these computers? Yes, there are risks. No, there are no risks. I did not raise my hand. Let's try this again. Yes, there are risks. No, there are no risks. Okay, so what are some risks? What do we think? What could go wrong? What's the problem with having all these computers? Yes?
Dependency.
What do you mean?
If we assume they're going to work and they suddenly don't work, then can't do many things without them.
Okay, so if they don't work, hold on, let me get so I can write this down. So there's this sense of dependency. We depend on them. So we come to depend on them. So that's only a problem if they vanish, right? Because if we depend on them and they're dependable, great. I depend on gravity. It's never let me down. Okay? But it is certainly true. What else? What are some other risks? Yes?
Loss of, personal
presence. Okay. They can be very impersonal. Even when you're talking to your phone and it's talking back in a neatly modulated voice created by some voice actor somewhere, it's still not like talking to a real person. There's a hand back. Yeah.
They take away jobs.
They take away jobs. Okay. Yes, they do. But we may talk about that. We may not. They take away jobs. Okay. Is there any useful technology that does not take away jobs? Somebody come up with any example of a useful technology that does not take away jobs.
Cars.
Paddles.
Paddles?
Yeah, like on a boat, you can't just
Well, actually, paddles do take away jobs. Because before there were paddles, how did we have to get these boats up the river? With people on the sides hauling ropes. How many people does it take to drag a boat with ropes as opposed to with a paddle? More people. Add paddles, we lose jobs. This is the nature of useful technology. Okay? If it's useful, by definition, it does something that was harder to do before. Therefore, it requires less effort to do that task. Therefore, the people that used to do it lose their job. Okay? But that doesn't make it any more comfortable if you're the one who's losing your job. Right? If I'm the guy that hauls on the ropes to bring the ship up the river, I don't like paddles. Okay? And computers continue taking more and more jobs all the time. So there's a real risk to individuals there. Although to the community as a whole, it's debatable. Other risks? Yes?
They're only as smart as the person that programmed them.
Okay, they are not smart. This is huge. We'll talk more about this. Yes?
They require a power source?
They need power! Of course, so do politicians, but we'll ignore that for the moment. Why is that a risk?
Because if you don't have a power source for them, they don't work.
Okay, so suddenly all of the risks that associated with electricity become risks of computers. And in computers everywhere, that gets a lot bigger. I have seen a movie where computers were a problem. What were they doing? What was wrong with the computers? Sorry, everybody at once, I can only hear five of you at a time. San, somebody. Yes, in the back. Terminator! I don't know what Terminator means. Okay, yeah.
There is no spoon.
There is no spoon. I don't know what there is no spoon means. Could somebody explain it to me?
Matrix.
Oh, Matrix, thank you. Okay? Yes?
Very skilled hacker.
Ah, hackers. We'll talk about hackers today. Hackers, control us. In the back.
The NSA.
The NSA. I have no privacy. What else?
iRobot.
There are so many of these Terminator-like things. And we don't mean the company that makes Roombas, I assume. I could be wrong. Yeah. It's always there. Nothing gets erased. We'll actually talk about that. It turns out that nothing gets erased if you want it to be erased, but if you don't, it vanishes surprisingly quickly. Anything else? Okay, so let's talk about some of these. We depend on them. Yes, absolutely we do. Can they be taken away? Yes, they can. There's this beautiful device called an EMF. You blow up a nuclear missile up in the upper atmosphere, it creates this electromagnetic pulse. All computers within a few hundred thousand feet, miles, depending on how big the bomb is, stop working forever. Okay? So we can do really serious things, take away from them. They are impersonal. This is true. This is a problem. We're going to teach you to speak their language. They will become more personal for you than they are for other people. But it's worth remembering that computers will never replace human interaction. They may facilitate it, but that facilitation does not always have all of the benefits of the original. Sometimes it has new ones. It's a lot easier to know the addresses of all of your friends and how many babies they have with Facebook than it was without. Okay? But it may not facilitate conversations. They take away jobs, we talked about that a bit. They're not smart, we'll talk about that a lot. They need power, is only a problem if we run out of power, but that comes back to we depend on them. So let's talk about some of these movie ones. Terminator, iRobot. The computer becomes smarter than the people. Pretty much as far as we can tell, this isn't actually a problem. We have a great deal of difficulty making computers do anything even vaguely interesting. And the idea that they could ever actually start learning things on their own is just a dream. And it's a really great dream that people have been working really, really hard on for 30 years and made zero progress. That's a little bit of an exaggeration. I did my PhD some in machine learning and artificial intelligence. But there's strong limits. The chance that Terminator will come along is right now essentially zero. Matrix, people using computers to fool us. I teach computer graphics. If in a couple semesters you want to take it, we'll talk about why computers right now are not very good at fooling the eye. But that might happen eventually. So we might be able to build a nasty matrix computer as long as it's run by somebody that isn't a computer. We'll talk about hackers more. NSA and all around, people know what you're doing. They know far more than you think they do. I could open a program on my computer right now and see every single packet that every single one of your computers is sending to the internet and what's coming back. I don't even have to do any fancy hacking. I just have to download the tool and start it. And I could see how many of you are on what websites and how long you've been there. And sometimes I could even catch usernames and passwords without really trying. Okay? If I wanted to work at it, I could do all kinds of nasty things. So it's a reasonable assumption. If it's on the computer, the whole world knows about it. It's not always true, but it sure makes your life safer. I do some research in family history technology, preserving histories of people. And one of the problems we have there is the opposite of this, the data is always there, right? You post something on Facebook, Facebook servers have it forever and ever, even if it was wrong and incriminating and so on. But if you want to preserve something, that's really hard. Because it just vanishes and like, we haven't got a digital technology that lasts more than a few years yet. So anyway, there's lots of risks here. We'll talk about some of these as the semester goes on. That's not really the main point of this course. But it's worth understanding how pervasive these things are that we're learning to talk to. And as we talk about them and think about them, we'll try to bring up some of these ideas as we go along. Okay. The main purpose of this class, instead of teaching you about computers, is teaching you programming. What is programming? It is teaching a computer what it should do. That's it. I need to tell the computer what I want it to do. I'm giving those instructions that change its future behavior. So, are computers good students? Compared to you, compared even to people in a less valuable university, are they any good? I would like you all to come up with either, yes, I think they are, or no, they think they aren't, but it's a complicated question, so talk to your neighbors and see if you can come up with an opinion. Conversation a bit. What makes a good student? What's some attributes of a good student? Yes? You only have to tell it to do something once. Oh, wouldn't that be nice? If we never repeated anything, we'd get three or four times as much material done in a semester as we can now. So yes, memory is good. What other things make a good student? Yeah?
The ability to think critically.
The ability to think critically. Yes, what does that mean? Does that mean complaining about things? Criticism? Yeah, critical thinking is a huge topic, but I like your summary, right? We take the information we have, and we understand more than was there. We understand something about it, something behind it, some additional information. That's really nice. That means that you can teach a small piece, and you'll figure out the rest on its own. What else? That's it? Okay, so, are computers good students? Yes, computers are good students. No, computers are bad students. Wow, most of you think they're bad students. That means you're setting yourself up for a really unpleasant experience. Let's talk about it. They never make any mistakes and they never forget anything unless you tell them to. And if you tell them to, they do and you never comes back. Okay? They're very obedient. You only have to say anything once. Great. But they are unbelievably stupid. Their inability to understand anything other than exactly what you told them will boggle your mind. You think this is a black and white thing, they only understand what you told them, and then you try it and you realize just how tedious and dull this can get. We'll talk about how to make it less tedious and dull, because you only have to tell it any given thing once. But you have to tell it everything, absolutely everything that it needs to know how to do. The lessons that we teach a computer we call code. Hey, this is not a perfect definition of code, but it's a pretty good one. It worked for now. So we're going to be teaching our computers to do things. We're going to have to teach them everything we ever want them to do, except for a tiny little piece that's already written for us. But they'll do it exactly right with absolutely no mistakes, and if they do something wrong, they didn't make the mistake. You did. Okay? And we'll talk about how to recognize those and so on. We'll even get some of that today. What is hacking? We mentioned hacking earlier. Okay? There's three ways the word hacking is used in general parlance. There is rapid development of code, speed teaching, if you will. There is sloppy development of code, teaching without paying attention to your students, if you will. And then there is trying to break other people's code. And usually when people that aren't already programmers think of hacking, they think of definition three. And that's fine, okay? So let's talk a little bit about hacking. Let's try to put this in context. We talked about how computers, we are teaching them what to do. So what does hacking mean? Usually when I write a program, I teach it what I want it to do, and then I try to tell it, don't listen to anybody else. Right? I don't want whoever's using my microwave to reprogram the buttons to change what the microwave does. I don't want the microwave to start computing square roots. I don't want it to start, you know, melting down to the core of the earth. I don't want it to do those things. So I try to not only say, here's what you can do, but say, and ignore every other voice in the world except mine when I come back to fix you when you're broken. Okay? This is really hard to do. There's entire fields of security based on this single question. How do you tell the computer to ignore everybody else? But that's what we try to do. What a hacker then is trying to do is figure out ways to get other people's code to listen to the hacker. Okay? So if I want to maliciously hack some system, I want to find out some way of getting that system to listen to me. And then I have to figure out what I want to tell it to do. So hacking is no easier than any other kind of coding. If I couldn't write it myself, I couldn't write it by hacking. And it's also harder because I have to convince the computer to listen to me. So most hacking exploits are pretty small. They don't do a whole lot, but what they do, they pick very carefully to make themselves money and make your life unpleasant. It's not magic, and there are ways of getting the computer to get better and better at not allowing it to happen. We're basically going to ignore this semester. So your computers will be just as hackable at the end as they were at the beginning. Partly that's because how you hack are all these sort of corner cases. They're the weird things you don't think about. And we don't have time to get into the weird things you don't think about while we're still teaching you the basic things we do. But that's what hacking is. Incidentally, most movies or television shows that include a hacker, there's somebody who sits down at a computer, it fills up with random stuff, and they start doing this. Okay? That would silly. Hacking is all, and all programming, is about thinking carefully about how you describe what you want to have happen into something the computer can understand. And most of the time you spend in any kind of programming is not involved hitting keys. You spend very little time involved hitting keys. Right? You may spend a couple of hours writing 20 lines of code. It doesn't take very long to type 20 lines, especially as sparse as computer code often is. So we'll see some of that as we go along. But there's no magic to it. It's just the same as any other programming with this little extra of getting somebody else's computer to do it instead of your own. Okay, so programming, we're going to program languages. So let's talk about languages. There's lots of languages. So I have here, on one side I have a picture of electricity. Surprisingly hard to get a picture of. It's actually a picture of light, but we'll pretend it's a picture of electricity. On the other side, we have a picture of the PowerPoint program I was using to create this slide deck while I was using it to create this slide deck. In particular, this slide. So, right, we want to get from electricity to a program, like PowerPoint. And we got a lot of steps in between. There's lots of layers of things that happen. So the electricity comes into the computer, and once it's inside the computer, we then go through a chip. Okay? So there's some sort of chip that has gates on it. There are several actual languages involved in writing these chips. If you want to learn about them, take computer engineering as opposed to computer science. I'm going to move right past them. But there are languages involved there. And then it goes from the chip, we've got the operating system. I know what an operating system is. I personally use more than 4 operating systems. Okay, yeah. So most people in this room probably are around 4, although you may not realize it. But that's sort of... it provides the basic services that abstract away the chip and make it easier to program. And then we've got various other layers here. There's a whole bunch of them. And finally, we are going to end up with Java. Okay? Lots of layers. What do I mean by layers? When I'm writing Java, I can ignore electricity. I don't have to worry about difference between a high volt and a low volt and what happens if there's a power fluctuation on the wire. Somebody else did that. I get to write my code in terms of something somebody else wrote at a lower layer. So I can sort of use all of these other pieces. So the operating system dealt with the fact that memory is a big grid and hid that from me, and I don't have to worry about it. And so on. So as we're doing Java, we're sort of going to doing one of these last layers. Lots of things have been written for us. I say you have to teach the computer everything. If you actually started with electricity, you'd have to teach it a whole lot more than the everything you'll think about. So there's a lot of these balances, and each of these passageways has multiple languages you can use it to define it. So there are multiple languages for describing chips, for designing them. There's multiple languages for writing operating systems. There's multiple languages at every step along the way. And including there's thousands of languages for writing programs. We'll be using Java. There's lots of reasons we might or might not want to use Java. We may talk about some of those as we go along. But more interesting is, why is it a language at all? Why do we call them languages? Instead of tools, instead of applications or programs or something. We call them languages because our goal is to communicate. Our goal is to teach the computer. And the normal way we teach is with language. That's how we've learned to teach. Okay? Is that the best way to teach? So unclear. But it's what we all know how to do, and so it's what we continue doing. There's also strange other reasons we continue using language. Keyboards get almost arbitrarily fast as you get good at using them. This is not true of mice. Mice have a physical limitation on how fast you could do. Keyboards don't. So anybody that's doing anything for a long time gravitates towards using the keyboard instead of the mouse. And so on. So we will see it's almost all text-based. There is almost nothing you have to do that doesn't involve the keyboard. And so on. That will be annoying at first. Eventually it'll make your life delightful. And we'll talk about it as we go along. Every language has at least 3 things you need to know about it. There's a syntax, a semantics, and a vocabulary. What do I mean? Syntax. Syntax is what makes something look kind of like a passage in the language. So for example, in English, I'm not allowed to put double quotes in the middle of a word, right? And they all need to be words, and so on. So that first line does not have good syntax. It doesn't even parse as a language. Any language, let alone English. Hey? Doesn't make sense. The second one does make sense, but the semantics are weird. Right? Put the tire in itself for chanting sneezes. It just doesn't... what? It's perfectly valid English, right? Syntactically, it's fine. All of the words are in the right place. You have verbs and nouns and so on where they belong, but it doesn't mean anything. Okay? So we'll be learning about the syntax and the semantics of the language Java. We'll also be learning vocabulary. So, I know what prandial soliation is gauche means. I am the only one. Hurrah. All right. So, it means don't wear hobnail boots to the dinner table. Okay? But there will be this vocabulary we'll be learning in Java. Java has a much smaller vocabulary than English. It will be so much easier to learn. But there's still a lot of terms we'll have to learn. Things that we're allowed to tell the computer that it already understands what they mean. And strangely, we'll spend a lot of our time defining new words, defining new things the computer can do. So we'll be adding to the vocabulary continuously as we write programs. Why do we call it code? Because it looks like gibberish until you know what it means, which is the general characteristic of codes. Okay? So I have here two examples of some code. The green is what's called x86 assembly in the NASM style for a Linux operating system. And on the yellowish orangish at the top there is a small piece of Java. Okay? Java is easier to read than NASM assembly, I hope you'll agree, but we'll see what it looks like as we go along. We'll learn what every piece of that means and why there's these weird periods instead of spaces and what system and so on. We'll learn all of that. Okay? But when you first look at it, it's going to look like a gibberish. It's going to look like code. One of the nice things about this code, though, is it's designed by somebody. Some person sat down and designed the language, all of it. So you don't have weird cases. It obeys its own rules. And as you learn those rules, it's easy, relatively easy to learn the language. Once you learn a few languages, you start to see the rules that are being used for all of them, and the rest follow very easily. Questions to this point? Things I should talk about more? Okay. Let's talk a little bit about programs. In particular, how they're going to look like for us. And we'll talk about bugs, too. We will start by creating some Java source code. What we write, that's what we call it. Is in the Java language, and it's something called source code. It's our version of teaching the computer what to do. The computer can't understand it. So it goes through some step called compiling. Compiling is sort of like translating from one language to another. Translating from a language that's easy for us to see to a language that's easy for the computer to see. The tool we will use this semester, called Eclipse, does the compiling for you without even telling you it's doing it. So every time you type anything, it's going to try to recompile it, and it's going to put little red squiggly lines under anything it didn't like. Okay? So this compiling phase is going to go on all the time. As you're compiling, you can figure out some things are wrong with your language. The guy that's doing the translating can figure out immediately if your syntax or vocabulary don't make any sense. And so those are the things you'll get red squiggly underlined as you're typing your code. Is bad syntax, bad vocabulary. And the syntax is going to be weird and annoying. There's going to be so many semicolons, you'll wonder what they're there for. Okay, but it's going to highlight them as you go. So it shouldn't be that hard to find them and hopefully fix them. After we compile, we get not yet a program. We get something called bytecode. Bytecode is another language. It's closer to what the computer wants to read. It's not quite the same thing. But we run the bytecode by using something called the Java Virtual Machine. Okay? And that creates some behaviors, the things we actually wanted to achieve in our program. In the process of trying to run it, trying to obey the instructions, we may find out the instructions don't make any sense. We may get the semantic errors there. Okay? So the semantic errors are called exceptions, and they involve things like, I asked the computer to divide 3 by 0, and it says, I can't divide by 0. It's a semantic error. It doesn't make any sense when I try to do it. It makes sense when you as far as the syntax goes, but the semantics of it don't. So once I try to run the program, exceptions will appear, these runtime semantic problems. But sometimes, often in fact, you'll get to the point where the program runs just fine and it does something weird. And you don't know why it's doing what it's doing. It's doing something. There's no errors. But it's doing the wrong thing. Okay? Actually, what it's doing is what you told it to do instead of what you meant to tell it to do. Okay? It always does what you tell it to do. It can't do anything else. It has no way of figuring out what you meant to tell it to do. It only does what you actually told it to do. So as you run the program, you wanted it to be adding and it's multiplying instead. And you're like, why is it doing this? Or you wanted it to be playing music and instead it's destroying files on your hard drive or whatever it is. Right? There's these logic errors. All of these are commonly called bugs. I know why they are called bugs. Okay, so trivia, but somewhat interesting. Early in the days of computers, a single computer would fill this entire room, and then a little bit more. And there's made out of these great big things called vacuum tubes, and you wired them all together, and to change how the program works, you didn't type something, you move wires. Okay? And one time a program wasn't working, and they were sure it should work, and they went in and they found a physical bug inside some of the wiring that had fried something. Okay? And ever since that day, way back in the late 50s, I think, we have called all kinds of problems with computers bugs. Okay? We still call them bugs today. Everybody calls them bugs. You will see lots of bugs. And we will try to walk you through recognizing and fixing them as you go along. The first three kinds, you will get to the point where you could just fix them pretty easily. By the end of the semester, you'll have seen a lot of them. You see one, you know roughly what you need to do to fix it. The last one will never go away if you don't understand the problem. So when we ask you to write a program to do something, if you don't know how to do it yourself as a human, you will never get the computer to do it. I don't care how much code you write, if you don't know what you're trying to teach it, you will never successfully teach it that thing. So you always, always want to start by thinking about the problem, thinking about logically, thinking about what happens first and what happens next. And we'll talk about that as we go along. But that's the hardest of the pieces here to teach. I won't have any trouble teaching you the rest of it. And I will do my best to teach you how to handle the logic. Okay? And we'll do various exercises along the way to try to make that easier and give you lots of experience. But that's the challenging part. So here's a text version of the previous slide. I don't remember why I made that. Okay, questions, comments, concerns, rebuttals? Okay, so we've talked about what computing is. We've talked a little bit about the flow and the structure of how it's going to work. Let's also talk a little bit about how this class is going to work. So, our goal is to teach you programming. We've talked about what that is. And there's a number of different pieces to that. Okay? So let's look at the schedule here. You'll notice on the schedule we're going to walk through different pieces. We're going to talk about the elements of a program. Okay? And then along the way we're going to have labs and we're going to have assignments. So you'll notice that next to each week I have written out on the side what the lab is going to be. And it's going to be a word like checkerboard and you're going to think, what is that? And until you show up you probably won't know. But we'll put descriptions of them up and so on. And we'll also give you homework. Where the homework is, teach the computer to do stuff. And at first we're going to say, teach the computer to do stupid stuff that you could do in your sleep, and it takes you so much longer to tell the computer to do it than to do it yourself, and why are we bothering? But at some point it's starting to get really complicated stuff, and you're going to say, oh, I wish we had the easy stuff again. We're going to try to pace it right. We're going to try to help this make sense as we go along. So we have these three components, the lectures, the labs, and the homework. I wish it was four components. I wish the book was part of it. If you make the book a part of it, your life will be easier. So we have these different pieces. Now, I've had a number of questions that I need to answer. So let me answer them now. There is podcasts. My recording software didn't work yesterday for the second lecture, but all the lectures in theory will be up there. So if you go to the lectures, you'll see them. If you click on a particular lecture, you will get to see a very rough announcement of what I'm going to talk about. Announcements and other things, they'll see their slides linked here. After lecture, I will probably export the slides that have markup on them and post them as well. Okay? There's lots of material here. If you happen to miss a lecture, this is where you want to go. Okay? And sometimes we won't get to everything on here. I didn't talk much about the comparisons between CS and other things. You're welcome to read them or ignore them or move on. We may talk about them in the other lecture. Depends on how the flow goes along. So we have these different pieces. So this week, again tomorrow, you've got a lab. Lab is going to be installing Eclipse in Java. You're welcome to start playing around with it right away, but as you look at the schedule, you will see we won't actually get to any Java until a week from Friday. So we'll get to have a little bit of time there. There's no class on Monday, in case you didn't know. I'm going to let you go a few minutes early because we're going to take you a lot of time next time.